It's Monday, December the 2nd, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Presidents of the United States traditionally have far more interest in domestic matters than in foreign affairs. Of the last several presidents, only three have had a demonstrated preference for dealing with foreign affairs. Those are President Richard Nixon, President Jimmy Carter, and President George H.W. Bush. The other presidents of recent terms have had to deal with foreign policy when it arose. And by the way, in terms of two of those three presidents who seem to be fixated and fascinated with foreign policy, George H.W. Bush and Jimmy Carter, the fact is they were both one-term presidents, at least in part because the American people thought they had a greater preference for foreign affairs than dealing with domestic challenges. President Barack Obama now finds himself in a very difficult situation, both domestically and internationally. But as the newspapers over the weekend made very clear, the international scene presses itself upon the American president and upon the American mind. The headline in Saturday-Sunday's edition of the Wall Street Journal over the weekend was that China raises the stakes in an air standoff. Many younger Americans may not be attuned to just how dangerous this situation is. As the Wall Street Journal reports, China raised the stakes in a standoff around its newly declared air defense zone on Friday when it said for the first time it had dispatched fighter jets to check on U.S. and Japanese military planes there, setting a precedent for what could now become routine high-speed aerial encounters over the East China Sea. End quote. Americans, like American presidents, are tempted to try to put issues of foreign policy and international affairs on the back burner. We also prefer to deal with domestic matters, matters closer to us, matters that have to do with our everyday lives. But when it comes to some international events, they really do have impact upon our everyday lives and upon the future shape of the world. And if these things do not have immediate relevance for us, you can be assured that they do for others. My point in raising this today is to make very clear that the world presses itself upon us. We can try to act as if we will deal only with our domestic concerns. An American president may want with all of his might to deal mostly with domestic concerns, but international concerns press themselves upon us. We live in a dangerous world, a complicated world, a world in which American interests are not the interests of the entire world. And even as American presidents may have very comforting visions of the way they think the world should be, it turns out that the world rarely cooperates. What's going on in China has high stakes. You have islands in the middle of the East China Sea that are claimed right now in terms of sovereignty by both China and Japan. And even as Japan has forsworn military action, now even the Japanese are having to reconsider their traditional pacifism after the end of the Second World War precisely because of the belligerence now coming from China. China's newfound assertiveness and aggression in the East China Sea has now come to this fly zone. What is being demanded here, in terms of the bottom line, is that China now wants every nation in the world to recognize its sovereignty over that airspace. If that appears to be an abstract reality, just consider the fact that airspace is indeed sovereign space, and what they're claiming is that what's underneath that airspace also belongs to China, in terms of the maritime and the island interests there. The dangers made very clear by Jeremy Page and Julian Barnes in the Wall Street Journal when they write, with China overtly challenging Japanese control of disputed islands in the area, such encounters raise the risk of a collision, a misunderstanding, or a confrontation between pilots that could quickly escalate into a military clash embroiling the United States. They then continue, there's also an increasing risk that all sides are becoming locked in a cycle of unusually public displays of military resolve that make it hard for any one of them to back down without losing credibility both internationally and at home. Interestingly, the United States has decided not to be a non-participant in this controversy. Just to make the point, President Obama ordered United States B-52 bombers to fly through this area in direct contradiction to Chinese claims. No jets were scrambled, but in following days, jets were scrambled with other sorties from both American and Japanese aircraft. The big question here in terms of immediate danger is to passenger aircraft. And if Americans living today have forgotten how dangerous this can be, let's go back to September the 1st in 1983, when jet aircraft of the Soviet Union shot down Korean Airlines Flight 007, killing 269 persons, including a currently serving United States congressman, Congressman Larry McDonald of Georgia. You'll recall that the situation in that case was almost exactly what we have here. The Soviet Union and Japan were both claiming sovereignty over a particular area that included Sakhalin Island in the Sea of Japan. The Soviet Union had warned that there should not be flights through that area without its permission. Korean Airlines Flight 007 was in the wrong place, and that Soviet aircraft, with great hostile intent, shot it down, even though, to even the casual observer, it was a Korean Airlines 747, filled with passengers of a civilian nature, not a military flight. We're talking about a very real danger. But in the larger sense, we're talking about the fact that in a fallen world, even a president of the United States cannot determine he's going to deal only with domestic matters. As intent as any president might be, and this president has lots of reasons to focus on domestic concerns, the reality is that the world presses in on him. Those concerns include Syria, where the president seems to have failed the test of international resolve, and Iran, where the president has decided to put the American prestige on a very flimsy agreement with the Iranians. Nonetheless, an agreement that may lead to international hope. On the other hand, it could lead to greater international danger. And then when it comes to other issues, including what's now going on over the East China Sea, the United States, no matter how it might will itself to be a non-participant, is. Our airlines fly through the area. And, as the international press well recognized, if the United States begins to recognize that airspace as being under Chinese sovereignty, it basically is giving that land to the Chinese at the expense of the Japanese. And if it seems like this is a very esoteric and abstract issue, I assure you it is not if you're flying on a jetliner flying through that very busy part of the international airspace. Well, just as American presidents don't get to decide what issues arrive on their agenda and arrive at their desk, also Christians don't get to decide what issues we're going to have to discuss. That was very apparent to me over the weekend when most Christians in America, at least, were talking about Thanksgiving, about the issues that surround the holiday season, about the transition to Christmas, and about the fact, indeed the largest cultural controversy going on over the weekend, about stores opening on Thanksgiving Day to do business. But in the evangelical world, another controversy arose, one that wasn't planned, it just happened. It was a controversy over rap music, and over the question about how Christians should understand rap music. And at the most fundamental level, it was a question about whether or not rap can be an appropriate medium for communicating the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's one of those controversies we didn't choose, it simply exploded. And explode it did over the weekend, especially after video posted to the internet had several evangelical leaders suggesting that rap was by its very nature an inappropriate medium for the communication of the gospel. That led to a lot of younger evangelicals, a lot of younger gospel-minded people to ask the question as to whether or not this was true. There was a pushback that was partly cultural, partly ethnic, partly generational. And, as I say, you don't get to choose your controversies. So looking at this question, I took a look at the arguments made by the panelists, the arguments that have made such a controversial landing in the evangelical mind. I understand the arguments. As a matter of fact, I have made them myself, in my head. I do know the arguments well. Form matters when it comes to music, and the form of music is not incidental to the meaning that is communicated. The biblical vision of music grows out of the union of the transcendentals, that is, the good, the beautiful, and the true, and because they are united in the very being of God. The union of the transcendentals means that Christians should seek only those musical expressions that best combine what is beautiful, what is good, and what is true. In other words, the only music we should listen to is Johann Sebastian Bach. In my view, Bach got it just about right. Even almost perfect. His music is an exhilaration of proportion and purpose, in which form and message are precisely, intentionally, even magnificently combined. Bach is never far from me, especially when I'm working and particularly when I am writing. As a matter of fact, I should probably acknowledge Bach in the acknowledgement section of my books. Neo-Orthodox theologian Karl Barth preferred to listen to Mozart, and I do love Mozart music, at least a lot of it. But Mozart is a genius in the way that Bach was not, and musical genius can easily get in the way of musical art. Add to this the fact that Mozart's worldview was seriously flawed. That explains why his magnificent but unfinished Requiem Mass in D minor is so moving, but so unsatisfying. Beethoven's pantheism and Enlightenment sensibilities don't ruin his music altogether, but they do make his incredible music rather inaccessible for Christian worship. Bach, on the other hand, is just about perfect. It's also important to know that Bach was a servant of the Lutheran Reformation. In his brilliant new book entitled Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven, conductor John Elliott Gardiner affirms that Bach saw himself extending the musical theology of Martin Luther, with the glory of God as his supreme purpose and the task of music, quote, to give expression and added eloquence to the biblical text, end quote. So, we should just end the development of church music and Christian musical artistry with Bach. But there's a problem with this proposal, and I write about it at my webpage today at albertmoeller.com. Bach was writing music that was understandable to the culture of his day, and not just to the elites. As a matter of fact, many among the elites didn't like his music, accusing Bach of using crude structures, lowly themes, and borrowing from unworthy musical sources. And then there's the issue of his pounding music as found in his famous organ works. Those pedal sequences in his toccatas are jarring to the senses and physical in reception and impression, hardly appropriate for use in church and the service of the gospel, many had argued at the time. And the people who would argue now about the unworthiness of rap music often think of Bach as perhaps the quintessential Christian musician. As I said already, I've made many of the same arguments myself, in my head. Thankfully not in public. Am I holding back? No, I allow myself those arguments in my head when I want to absolutize my preferences and satisfy myself in the righteousness and superiority of my own musical taste and theology. The problem for me is that my theology of music won't allow me to stay self-satisfied on the matter, and by God's grace, I've not made arguments out loud that would violate that theology. Rap music, let me make clear, is not my music. I do not come from a culture in which rap music is the medium of communication, and I honestly don't have the ear for it that I have for other forms of music. But I do admire its virtuosity, its ability to communicate, and the hold that it has on so many, for whom it is a first and dominant musical language. I want that language taken for the cause of the gospel, and I pray to see a generation of young gospel-driven rappers take dominion of that music for the glory of God. I see that happening now, and I rejoice in it. I want to see them grow even more in influence, reaching people I can't reach with music that will reach millions who desperately need the gospel. They need the gospel the same way that folks who first heard Bach desperately needed to hear the gospel in their time. The good, the beautiful, and the true are to be combined to the greatest extent possible in every Christian endeavor, rap included. I have no idea how to evaluate any given rap musical expression, but rappers know. I do know how to evaluate the words, and when the words are saturated with the gospel and biblical truth, that is a wonderful thing. Our rapping gospel friends will encourage one another to the greatest artistic expression. I want to encourage them in the gospel. Let Bach's maxim drive them all, to make their music, as Bach called it, the handmaid of theology. As I wrote this piece for AlbertMuller.com, Bach's English Suite No. 3 in G minor was playing. It makes me happy to hear it. But knowing that the gospel is being taken to the ears and hearts of a new generation by a cadre of gifted young gospel rappers makes me far happier. Once again, you can find my article about this controversy entitled Thinking About Rap, Unexpected Thoughts Over Thanksgiving at my website at AlbertMuller.com. In recent days, something else took place that ought to have our attention. It was a news story that didn't get enough attention in the Christian world. It has to do with the Scottsboro Boys of Alabama and with the pardon that came posthumously, but at least it did come. As the Dallas Morning News reported, last month, Alabama, that is the state, posthumously pardoned three black men who had been falsely convicted more than 80 years ago in the rapes of two white women, thus absolving the last of those who have been known as the Scottsboro Boys. During a hearing in Montgomery, the Alabama Board of Pardons and Paroles voted unanimously to issue pardons to the three men, Haywood Patterson, Charles Weems, and James A. Wright, all of whom were convicted of this crime back in the 1930s. As the Dallas Morning News reported, the case, which yielded two landmark Supreme Court rulings about the inclusion of blacks on juries and the needs for adequate legal representation, had continued to hang over the state of Alabama as an enduring mark of its tainted segregationist past. The last of the men died in 1989. Now, by the way, we should say that this actual affair has hung over the American conscience, not just the state of Alabama, because all of America, in its own way, was complicit in the conviction of the Scottsboro Boys and should now recognize the meaning of the fact that the last three were pardoned, though posthumously, just in recent days. Senator Arthur Orr, a sponsor of the legislation that brought about the pardons, said, and I quote, "We're certainly a different state in the 21st century than we were. Today's the final chapter, and it ends on a brighter note of a very tragic chapter in our history." As the news reports recount, these men were among a group of nine first tried in April of 1931 for a rape after a fight aboard a train passing through Jackson County, Alabama. Within 3 weeks of the fight, an Alabama judge had sentenced eight of the men to death after their convictions by an all-white jury, or actually in this case, all-white juries. One of the things we need to note here is that the presumed victim of the rapes later recanted and said no rape had taken place. A fight had taken place, but here you had men who were convicted and given the death penalty for a rape that didn't happen. The Supreme Court did intervene in the year 1932 and overturned the convictions that set off a long system of trials and a sequence that continued well over the next decade. Prosecutors dropped the rape charges against five of the men in 1937, but four others, including the three who were pardoned just this last month, were convicted again and sentenced to lengthy prison terms or to death. Recently, the state of Alabama, its legislature, adopted a measure that was unanimously approved, by the way, that created a process whereby Alabama authorities could issue pardons in select felony cases, quote, to remedy social injustice associated with racial discrimination. And then Senator Orr said this, today is a reminder that it is never too late to right a wrong. We cannot go back in time and change the course of history, but we can change how we respond to history. He concluded, quote, the passage of time and doing nothing is no excuse. This hearing marks a significant milestone for these young men, their families, and for our great state by officially recognizing and correcting a tremendous wrong, end quote. Of course, the men he refers to here as young men are no longer young. As a matter of fact, they're no longer alive. So why is this important? Well, again and again, we have to come to the fact that the Christian understanding of justice means that it is never too late to try to make justice real. That's why, as we've noted in so many different cases, it's right for investigators and prosecutors to go after even very elderly men hiding out as the very last of those who were guilty of the Nazi war crimes. Even though it appears to be rather useless in terms of the great scale of human justice to bring people in the 10th decade of life before the court of justice, in terms of a Christian understanding, it's not only right, it's necessary. But the flip side of that is when justice goes wrong, it's just as necessary to set it right, and it's never too late. Even though these three men received their pardons posthumously, at least the historical record is set straight. That must bring some solace to their heirs and the generations following. But more importantly, it must bring some satisfaction to that sense of justice that God put within his human creatures, not only in the state of Alabama, but far beyond. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to our website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.